Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Misha Tate, and you're listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Tish Duran, and you're listening to Carson's Corner. Make sure you stay tuned in.
This is Justin Ray Harvey, Frank Duke's student. You're listening to the best of the best shows on the web and beyond. Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Bo, the one-man army Taylor, media darling and Midwest champion of the world. You're listening to the only radio show that's hard-hitting, keeps it real, and does not pull punches. Carson's Corner.
This is the coach, Sean Tompkins, and you're listening to the best in mixed martial arts, Carson's Corner.
Okay, let's go. Yeah, g'day, this is Justin Lawrence calling from my backyard in Australia, mate. You're listening to Bob Carson, the finest investigative journalist in mixed martial arts history. Listen to his show, I love it.
Hey, this is Joey Odessa, and you're listening to me on the Bob Carson Show, the show that lets no words barred give a whole new perspective to no holds barred.
These days, it's not much fun at Bally's and Caesars in Atlantic City. The CEO is playing the corporate greed game, cutting dealers' hours, cutting retirement and health benefits, even breaking the law by refusing to bargain. Yet he paid himself $39 million last year, with plenty of perks.
Place your bet.
When Bally's and Caesars play games with casino dealers, it's not fun for anybody. And everybody loses. That's why the UAW Atlantic City Dealers Union paid for this time.
Hello, everyone around the world. Once again, this is Carson's Corner, and my name is Bob Carson, and today we're going to delve away from the world of mixed martial arts, as we do on the show often, and talk politics. That's right, New York City politics. We're going to talk to a gentleman, a fine gentleman who's running for city council in District 1 in New York City, Sean Hayes. We have him on the line. We also have someone who's no stranger to this program, someone who I consider a personal friend, who's been on this program many times. I don't think he needs any introduction to you. Matthew, the Connecticut Granahan, who's going to be working with Sean on his campaign, is on the program as well. This is very, very exciting. If you want to call and be a part of the program, you can. 516-418-5570. That's 516-418-5570. So, without further ado, let's bring on Mr. Sean Hayes and, of course, Matthew Granahan to the program. Gentlemen, how are you today?
Excellent. Thank you so much. This is Sean.
And it's Matt here.
Hey,
you're
Sean.
Doing great, Bob. Great to be on with you again.
Yes, absolutely. I'm really excited for this discussion. I'm really, really excited to get to know you, Sean, because I think it's just really, really pivotal. We're in a pivotal point, you know, whether it's local politics, whether it's national. We're just in a time period that's very, very important before us. So, you know, I kind of want to just start off with you, Sean, and get an idea of who you are, your background. You know, and ultimately why you are deciding to run before we, you know, get into other issues.
Oh, sure. So I'm actually from Ozone Park, Queens. So I was brought up young age in Queens, and then I actually moved off to Fairfield, Connecticut, and then finally to West Haven, Connecticut. And after law school, I chose to go overseas. So I went overseas and I was working for a law firm overseas, and also worked for South Korean highest court and was a CEO of a company and did a lot of things overseas. And for the last 18 years, I was working back and forth between South Korea, China, Southeast Asia, the Philippines, and here. And I came back and I was only coming back a few times each year. But I actually noticed over that time period, things are changing. And they're changing in an actual way that I don't understand anymore. I can recall the time when Giuliani got into office. I think most people realized at that time there was a need for a change, right? And they didn't care he was a Democrat, Republican. Is he really a Republican? That was a big issue when he was in the night. Because he's not. He's really a Democrat, right? He's changed these days. He's gone a little more right. But I think we're at the same time. I think we're in a huge, huge crisis. We have terrible politicians in office. They're not focused on the actual needs, the day-to-day needs, and they're actually focused on higher office and also polarizing issues. Defund the police.
Right.
It's just absurd. It's absolutely absurd. And I think these issues are what motivated me, and also friendships. People called me and said, why don't you do this? You're actually back home full time now. Why don't you do something? And I felt called to actually do something. And city council, if I actually win, it's probably going to be the worst thing that ever happened to me. It's going to affect my income substantially, going to affect my law firm substantially. But I sincerely felt called. I think we're in a serious crisis, and we're at the stage of returning back to those dark days of the 80s and early 90s. And that's why I'm in this, and I want to bring more, just want to bring back into politics that pragmatic viewpoint that most New York politicians had. So most New York politicians always defaulted to the middle and would be willing to bargain with the other side and make deals. That's finished now, completely finished.
Yeah, you mentioned a lot, and we're going to talk a lot about a lot of stuff today, and how you can improve New York, because that's obviously not an easy task. I mean, many have tried and many have failed. And you mentioned pragmatism. Your campaign slogan is balanced and pragmatic solutions through experienced leadership, which I can get behind, and certainly a lot of people can get behind. But before we talk about that, Sean, and we have Matthew Granahan on the line. If you mentioned, you know, bad politicians and you know the problems and the corruptions. You've got Governor Cuomo in the state house. You know, sort of the elephant in the room here. A conservative friend of mine tried to convince me to wear a T-shirt reading Cuomo has got to go before this mess started. Part of me wishes that I agreed, but it's just absolutely insane. Of course, being accused of misconduct, a nursing home cover up, and so on and so forth. What is your take? Is Cuomo embarrassing the city and state at this point?
I don't believe so. I think it's way too soon to know what actually happened. I'm not a huge backer of Cuomo. He's also gone far left. But if you look at anyone else in the Democratic Party, they've gone uber far left. So I'm backing Cuomo right now because he's a voice of moderation in a Democratic Party in this city. It's obviously not everywhere that has gone uber far left. So he's not anti-cop, and he's not anti-pragmatism. He did definitely pander to the far-left base with some of the reforms in bail law, which I think is the fundamental cause of the problems that we're having now. But I think overall he was a decent governor. We can always argue with his actual choices that happened with the pandemic. I believe he went way too far. However, he had that actual right at that time to make that choice, and I believe he erred on the side of caution. Some people believe that was the right choice. Some people believe it was the wrong choice. However, I don't see many other voices like him that are a voice of moderation, and that's why I don't think we should jump to any end right now. And what's actually happening with this is it's two parts of the party fighting. It's not over the actual issues. It's over the radical left side and Cuomo's side fighting back and forth. And this all has to do with what? The mayor race. And the governor race next year. You know, I mean, this is just dirty inter-party politics, because the Republican Party does not have a chance to win in anywhere in the city.
Yeah, you got Andrew Yang, who apparently is the front runner for governor in the future. He seems like a nice guy who's looking for pragmatic solutions. Plus, he's, you know, he has a calm demeanor as far as his temperament and whatnot. But, you know, you're right. The New Yorkers are kind of split on this as far as what I've seen as far as Cuomo and whatnot. You know, so it's kind of it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out and whatnot. Let's jump right into some of these issues. I know that, you know, you mentioned crime, and crime is a particular concern of yours. What do you see as being behind some of the very worrying increases in crime, particularly violent ones that we've seen recently, you know, in the subway, the attacks and whatnot? It just seems to be increasing in a very, very bad environment there.
I think, you know, some people say it's because dynamics changed with the pandemic. But first of all, that doesn't make sense. So if dynamics change, just think about this. They were less places open that you would be able to actually rob, right? So wouldn't you think gun violence would go down? So some people are saying it's just a dynamics change, or it's economic issues. But economic issues don't make sense either. So the only reason why I'm doing this is I want to start with what the other side says. Their largest argument is that dynamic change, but it doesn't account for the type of violence that we're actually having. We're having violent crime violence. I can understand an issue of economics if we can show data where economics does actually lead to higher crime, but we can't show that. In actuality, 1989 is when we had the highest homicide rate. Mm-hmm. 2016, it was lower than 1989. 2016, the poverty rate was higher than in 1989. And there's a bunch of stats like this. Sometimes economic issues do increase crime, but it's petty burglaries and it's stuff like that. It's nuisance crimes, not the violent crimes. So I think there's no evidence that it's a pandemic problem. And that's what the radical Uber left is trying to push. This is just economics. It's going to clear up after economics. I think we can see directly that when the bail law changed, crime rate went up. We have more people out in the actual street, and I can understand the actual bail rate. It is unfair. So the system is someone needs to post, let's say, a $5,000 bond. Someone like me can actually post it. Some other people can't post it. That is fundamentally unfair, right? But the system didn't change. We have no change in the actual system. The problem is a judge cannot confine someone who the judge deems as dangerous. So that's the actual critical change that also needed to happen. If you want to scrap cash bail, which I can understand, we need to allow an actual judge to confine someone that judge believes is dangerous. And they don't have the power in this city for generations. The judge didn't have that right. The way they actually did it was through the cash bail. They would post a higher cash bail sum, and the person could not pay that sum, and we knew they were not able to get out. So I think that's issue number one. The bail reform led dangerous people on the street. Number two, we have prosecutors in this city that have gone far, far left. Certain crimes they just won't prosecute. And they believe that even violent criminals with guns should go into alternate programs. So meaning they don't actually go in jail. One program, and it has expanded to even people caught with a gun, is you will not have a criminal record if you go to an art class. That's in Brooklyn. So they got a Brooklyn art class, and they send people that were caught with guns. It's usually people selling drugs, and they're caught with guns, and they send them to art therapy. And maybe this works, but at a young age, you're often talking about people that need to be punished. And I have people on my actual campaign now that have served time in jail. And
yeah.
They would say right now that serving time in jail was good for them. It taught them something. And I don't believe what we should do is stick people in jail and when they actually get out of jail, just throw them in front of the fire. I also believe in a second chance program.
Right.
Give someone hope. Give someone an opportunity. Give someone a specific roadmap where they can do well. And I think we need to expand that in the jails, and we also need to expand it once people get out of jails. Because this is sad. We have a very large part of our population that do not feel hope. I went out to the projects, and I talked to people. I talked to so many people. They were in jail. They can't get jobs now with that actual criminal record. They're no longer 25 years old. These are guys in
right.
their 30s and 40s. They've
right.
grown up. I think all of us talking here, we all done some stupid things when we were actually young, right? And some
sure,
of that
yeah.
that stupid stuff, like drunk driving or something, if you get caught up in any of that, you had an accident, someone died in that accident, your life is basically finished. You'll never
yeah.
have a professional job in your life. And that's wrong, too. So I'm definitely for strong punishments, but we also need to have on the back end of that, once people do get out of jail, give them an opportunity. Give them an opportunity for hope. Given an opportunity to help them build an actual roadmap to something that they would like to do in their lives, or we're having a huge part of our population that will always be on public aid, will never pay taxes, and will
right.
never feel good about their actual life, and that's wrong.
Sean, I just want to get your – I want to go to Matthew Grennan in just a moment, but I just want to get your take on what we're talking about, crime. I mean, one thing I think is for certain, when police budgets are cut and police are demoralized, you know, crime rises. And I understand that some people want, you know, resources redirected to non-policing solutions, such as increased mental health support and social work environments and interventions. What is your take on those initiatives? Is that something that you think could certainly help reduce crime and put people, you know, on a straightened path?
I think it could, only if it's under the NYPD. So I think the problem is, if you get people from, at least in this city, from the social service world, they often
mm-hmm.
do not think of punishment. So that's my biggest worry. Will everything be handled through an appeasement program? And I think fundamentally peace comes through strength. So that's my philosophy in life. I think if we have a strong police force that people know will pick you up if you do A, B, C, and D, we're most likely not going to be doing A, B, C, and D. And appeasement just doesn't work. This concept that we need to always understand. In some cases, we just need to have tough love. So my fear is, if this is handled where a call goes out, let's say I phone and there's a homeless person who is causing trouble in front of the building here. Now, if I call and the police don't come out, and in actuality, who comes out is a social worker. My fear is the social worker, if the social worker is not being managed by the police, will not be defaulting to a program of tough love. They'll be looking at the root cause of the problem, and it doesn't solve the immediate need of the people in the area. And also with just the laws that we have in this city, even if someone does have mental health issues, they have the right not to receive treatments, and that's a big issue. So if someone cannot choose right from wrong, is not able to choose if medicine is good for them, and they don't take medicine that will stabilize them, what do we do? Is it still an appeasement program at that stage? So that's when we get people with mental health issues going into the penal system. And I think the major nuisance crimes that we see these days is called by mental health issues. What we've done is we've released people from mental hospitals, and we put them in hotels all around the city. The Upper West Side has one. They also have one down by me near Battery Park City. And they're in these 3- and 4-star hotels. And they're mainly people with mental illness.
Matthew?
Hey, Bob. Interesting discussion. And I want to thank you again for having me on the show. A little bit of a different subject matter. But it's really not that dissimilar, Bob, to the last time you had me on, because we got a little bit into politics in that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you know, these are issues that we're talking about, you know, bail reform, a crime, mental illness. You know, I think what's happening in New York City is a microcosm of you know, what's happening nationally and whatnot. And as I said at the beginning of the show, this is really, really a pivotal time in our nation's history, I think, you know, politically. When things are changing, you know, kind of rapidly, I think within the Democratic Party, nationally, of course, and locally, and the Republican Party, but one thing I think, Sean, that you mentioned on your website, and by the way, your website is SeanHayesForNYC.com. SeanHayesForNYC.com. I really, really enjoyed visiting it because it lays out your platform it lays out your background, so people can kind of really get familiar with what you espouse and what you're offering. But one thing that you talk about is political polarization, demonization of others, and there doesn't seem to be an attempt anywhere to really reach across the aisle and try to solve problems. I hear this a lot. The media is completely, I think, biased in one favor or another, one direction or another. How do you plan to really make an impact in this day of political polarization, where you're either this or where you're either that, and you know, the idea of working with the other party is just almost unfathomable?
Yeah, I think it's very hard answer, but I think the answer is also obvious. The parties are the actual problem. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party got way off base. The Republican Party was all values, small government, low tax, right? Now, if you like Trump or not, his policies, throw his actual policies out of it. He's definitely not someone who you would think of as someone that would be the epitome of family values, right? So I think the Republicans with Trump got off base, and that's not necessarily wrong for the Republicans, because they were losing their actual base. So I think Trump is more of a Democrat candidate, a traditional Democrat candidate, a John F. Kennedy type Democrat candidate, than we had on the opposite side. I think the Democratic Party has moved from a party of the union labor, a party of the hardworking man, right? That was the party, and it's moved from that, and it's moved into identity politics. So I think the answer is obvious. What we need to do is, in this city, the city council has 51 members, and there's only 3 Republicans. There's 2 in Staten Island, and there's 1 in Howard Beach. So a Republican will not win, but there's many people like me, and I think most voters are like me. They're moderate people. They want to hear both sides. They want to try to solve problems. They want to understand what the issue is, get their hands dirty. And I think that's most voters. But you know what happens? We don't vote in primaries. So if you're an independent, you made a huge mistake. vote in a primary and vote in a primary that actually matters. If you're an independent right now and you're in a district like mine that will go Democrat, register as a Democrat and vote in the Democratic primary because the general doesn't matter. That's the reality, and that's the problem. We do not vote in primaries, and not voting in primaries is leading to the more radical on each side. I mean, this is not a Democrat or a Republican issue. If you don't have opposition, the people that will win are the people in the extremes because they're the people that are motivated. The extremes are the ones that are motivated, will always come out to vote, and they'll also donate money to these causes. So I think the answer is easy. Will we vote in primaries is the actual question. Will we do it? My race, I will win if I get 4,000 votes. And there's 60,000 voters in this area. There's 60,000 Democratic voters in this area. And if I get 4,000, I will win. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
It's crazy, Bob, because what drew me to the campaign originally was the polarization that we're talking about here. You know, to me, it's like no one's having a real conversation anymore.
Right.
And when Facebook started, and I think I got on Facebook 2008, you didn't see a lot of political posts back then.
Right.
And now you all these political posts, but it's not productive political posts. It's not discussions. People are seeking confirmation, not information.
Yeah.
And it's become like the new sport, like when there were no sports being played during the coronavirus, when everything was shut down. People on both sides were looking at each other like, I'm the Red Sox, I'm the Yankees. You know, my and the other aspect of it too, Bob, is you really should never be a fan of a politician. You know, it's laughable to me, and you see it on both sides. You see it a lot with the Trump people and with the never Trump people, where they're fans of a politician. I think you ought to be more logical to be a fan of your bartender than a fan of a politician, because politicians are supposed to be public servants, right?
Right.
And they're supposed to listen to the people. And one of the things that I'm looking forward to doing with this campaign is when I arrive in New York, is like I was doing with listening to you guys chat. It's just chat up with the people and see what people of District 1 in New York, what are their concerns? And politicians aren't doing that. And Sean Hayes is one of the very few that is.
Yeah. Very good point.
I'm proud to be able to actually go out. It's a blessing. I learned so much.
Right.
And just to go out and talk to people and to talk to people I generally wouldn't talk to, which is fantastic. I had a couple of guys say, you know, you're the only white guy that ever came here in a suit that was not an FBI agent or a DEA agent, and you're actually listening to us. So it was a joke. I had people tell me this is a joke, but there's very few people. And I would always ask people, I would ask them, I would first say, "What I really want to learn from you, right?
Right.
And what can you teach me about your actual problems?" And just starting the actual dynamics with that, people don't have other people asking them for their opinions anymore. I don't know everything. You know, what do I know? I know what I see that's in front of me. And how many people really look beyond what they want to see? That's the key. And I'm willing to change my viewpoints on issues, and I'm willing to say I'm wrong. And I don't think we have many people like that anymore in politics, and I don't know why.
I agree.
And I hope I can motivate other people to come forward and really, you know,
guys,
serve, really think about.
You know, guys, on the national stage in this last election, I think Tulsi Gabbard, to me, was a breath of fresh air because she worked with Republicans on the other side and was open to, like she said, open to changing her views on different things and listening to the people. And aside from her, that's very rare on the national stage. in politics.
Yeah, that's
right. It's that bumper sticker mentality.
Well, you know, the message of centrism is the most neglected ideology or ideological position in our highly polarized times. And I think that breeds apathy amongst people out there, which, you know, could be the reason why, in part, that they don't vote in the primaries. And it's very, very frustrating to people like me and Matthew. We've talked about this on the program. How there isn't that. It's either you're on one side or the other. It's the left sees racism everywhere, and I think the right sees communism everywhere, and you know, there's a stifling of debate when you really go down that road. Sean, you know, you mentioned you getting to know the constituents out there of District 1 in New York City. Based on what you've learned from them, what would you say are maybe the two or three top issues that are facing the people that ultimately you want to get their vote?
Yeah, I think it's up to age and actually race. So if you're talking about younger people that are Hispanic and Black, it's jobs, definitely jobs, and they want to work and they want good jobs. Some people have criminal records, and this is a small subsection of that subsection. So I think number one, people want hope, and they want, and hope is a good job and being able to support your family on that job. Number two, the public housing complexes, some of them are okay, but I visited some of them, and the number one thing that people said is these places are a dump. There's crack addicts in the hallways at nighttime. There's no police here. We have I saw one running water down the side of this man's wall. They patched the actual leak, took off his cabinets. 2 years later, they never put up his cabinets. And I saw so many people said the same thing. Just the maintenance of these buildings it's terrible. I was in South Korea, and I even visited North Korea. I went to North Korea three times, Pyongyang. The buildings there are not as bad as some of these buildings. I mean, it's shameful. And I think number three, this is the same for everyone else, education. You know, if you see families with children, they talk about education. They talk about how will they be able to pay for college. And some of it is just education. They don't understand that they are Pell Grants and that they are student aid and such. And I think that's the three things that people are talking about generally. In my area, it has some specific issues, too, that some people talk about. Some people do not want big buildings being built here, luxury buildings being built, because it's believed to increase everyone else's rent in the area, and it also leads to certain shops coming in that the people that are here now would not be able to afford later. That's a fringe issue that is in certain areas, and some people don't like that their public housing's view will be blocked and issues like that. I think this is a really small issue in most districts, but as you know, politics is all local, and the individual sometimes does have issues with like that, and development needs to happen. We understand it, but we still need to have programs of affordable housing. And I don't think we should get rid of our public housing. We should fix it up. And I believe also when we build these big buildings, let's keep affordable housing range, 25-30% of the apartments in these unions should be affordable housing. And that's what our law is now. So some people are fighting based on not an understanding that the side effects are being solved. They are, you know, once you have more affordable housing, why would that mean that your rent would go up? You actually have more housing stock in that area. So some of it is people preying off lower information voters. That's what I fear. And it's easy to come forward with sound bites. Your rent's going to go up. How is your rent going to go up? It's a public housing complex. So it some of it doesn't even make sense.
Yeah, we have the same issues.
Sean, you think there's a misunderstanding?
What's that, Matt?
I was just going to say to you, so you think in the public housing there's a misunderstanding? I missed that last part.
Yeah, I think what's happening is people are being spun. So they're being spun to actually believe if the building next door is a luxury building, it's going to mean that their rent is going to go up. And that's not the actual case. Number two, they believe that other houses that are not public housing, those rents will go up too. But when you have more stock, when you actually have more affordable housing stock, so the Two Bridges program is four large towers where 25% to 30% of the units are affordable housing units. And you have to make, I think in this district, it's about 55,000. You have to make less than 55,000. So that would generally be someone who would be living in, let's say Chinatown, in a two-bedroom place, maybe it would be $2,500, right? So that would be that type of range person, 55,000. If we have more affordable housing, why would those other units' prices go up? It just doesn't make sense. But they have been spun to believe that.
Do you think it could all be – because to be honest with you, Sean, I am really not familiar with how, city council works and how you guys get a budget. Mm-hmm. But I would imagine that what's happening at the State House, the State House, New York has got federal money from the COVID relief bill that was just passed that – that would certainly have an effect on what's going on at the district level. Do you think that rents going up, people not being able to afford jobs or not being able to get decent jobs to support themselves has anything to do with what's going on in Albany as far as maybe some of the fiscal irresponsibility of New York?
For sure. To actually do business in the city or state, who's going to choose to move to this state these days?
Right.
It's too expensive.
My
effective tax rate in this city is around 12%. That's the effective tax rate. That's what I'll actually pay off my income. And obviously that's excluding the federal tax. Now, this is my biggest worry. Crime's going up, services are down, and do you think people are just going to be willing to pay this higher tax? And the taxes are going to go up this year. It's already done. It's already a done deal. That's why we see so many people fleeing to Florida. I think we are losing, like in the 80s. We're losing our productive members, and 5% pay about 63% of the income tax, and that's the people that are leaving. The school-age parents still want to send their children to Stuyvesant High School and high schools like that, right? But then afterwards, I think so many of them will just leave. And that's my big, big worry. That's why I want to focus on crime, and I also want to focus on education. And also, crime does go down when we have more people working. Right, it's just a fact. Violent crime is a different story. That's a hard one. But all the petty crimes, a lot of it has to do with people just not having access to decent jobs.
Financial, yeah. So Sean, another aspect of that I see from living down in South Carolina, and also having family in Florida, is. I've had three friends from Connecticut just in the last few months move to either the Charlotte area of North Carolina or to Florida. And one of them was a buddy of mine that worked in the city. And one of the reasons why now, and this was really enhanced after COVID and Corona, you don't need to live in the city anymore because people are able to do their jobs remotely now. My sister is right about to move to Florida as we speak now because she doesn't need to live in New York anymore. So there's that aspect too. People can have a job in New York and live anywhere in the country, and why would they want to live in New York?
Yeah, I think that is right, and I think that's going to affect some people that are not from this area. I think the bigger issue is these companies were in this area because this was a great place to actually live, right? So
yeah.
Some companies like GE moved to Fairfield, Connecticut, let's say, you know, and then they moved to Massachusetts, right? But they were in the city and they moved to the outskirts, but they still wanted to stay close to the actual city. So I think this is also a place that people really do want to live in. But to live in it, what do we need? And I'm talking about taxpayers. So I think some people would be willing to pay more, like me. I want to live in the actual city. I love to look outside. I love these sirens, which I can actually hear in the background here sometimes. I love a busy city, a big city where I don't need a car. So some people love that. But we will get scared out when the taxes are too high and we can't take the subway anymore. So the subway is up. Nighttime, you don't want to go on it anymore. It's terrible. I mean, it's scary for me, and I'm not a small guy. And I've seen all kinds of odd things. I saw one guy with this knife behind his back, and he was mumbling, "Oh, I need to save her. I need to save her." Wow. I've seen people half naked on the, you know, and there's no cops anymore. The cops don't want to be blamed, and the cops have been told to be hands off. And I've talked to police about this too. And I think if that happens, we're going to see more people flee. My worry. The pandemic is a different thing. The restructuring of buildings and stuff like that. I think it's going to be a huge crisis, but not all of those people necessarily will move to Florida, right? We can still
Florida or North Carolina, South Carolina.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so many of them are. I mean, I've been out of the Northeast. It's going to be 17 years now, and I've had in the course of living here so many people move to either Raleigh or Charlotte, Charleston. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now Florida is so big now that with real estate, like my folks just moved there. And my dad said every house he went to look at, they'd make a list. They'd look at like 5-6 houses. That day they'd go and look at them and they'd be under contract. So, and then he had a house in North Carolina that they just sold. They sold it in a day. He had 4 offers in a day. So it's unbelievable. The number of people, I don't think it's underestimated to say that because of the way people work now, the way we work now remotely, you're seeing a mass exodus. And it's not just from New York City. It's from our home state of Connecticut, my home state of Connecticut as well. And New Jersey too, right?
Yeah. New Jersey, my whole family, my brother just moved to Florida. His girlfriend's moving to Florida. My cousins moved to South Carolina, and my sister has a house in Florida. And after her 2 kids graduate college, she's going to Florida. I'll be the only one left in New Jersey. And as I told you, Matt, I can't articulate why I'm even in the state anymore, because New Jersey is very, very expensive to live, as you both could imagine. So you're absolutely right. There's a mass exodus. And, Sean, you know, a lot of this ties back to crime. I mean, you know, taxes, yes, an eroding tax base, higher taxes. In New York, you know, wasteful spending, abuse, fraud, a low morale in when it comes to our politicians. All of this contributes to, you know, a cycle of disinvestment and contributes to people just leaving the state. I ask you about about crime, an increase in crime. You know, we talked about police and. How can we fix that? I mean, one thing that's been really a hot topic in the media is qualified immunity, which you've spoken about, where you argued, I think that there's a lot of truth to this. It creates a chilling effect where police are more reluctant to intervene in situations where they could end up being sued. Demoralized police force that I don't think gets the support from. The mayor de Blasio there. What can we do as far as, police officers, their morale in driving down the crime rates there?
I think it's we need to look at what worked in the actual past and just duplicate what worked in the past. So if we look at the 70s, 80s crime rates up to mid 80s, and then we had a big spike in like 86, 87, 88, 89 was even worse. So 70s and up to mid 80s were really bad. And then like 85 to 90 were really, really bad. And then Giuliani came in the mid-90s and cleaned things up. How did he clean things up? He gave power to the actual police to stop and frisk, which we can't do anymore. It's been deemed unconstitutional, and it was deemed unconstitutional at the lowest federal court, and it was never appealed to the highest court. Stop and frisk had problems. Definitely we were flagging more black people than other people and flagging young people more than other people. I mean, it had problems. But why didn't we look at that time to solving those problems, not just scrapping stop and frisk? So I think one thing, we will never return to stop and frisk, but how can we return to something like stop and frisk? Also, what has been cut back on is programs that are like stop and frisk, special investigative units, plainclothes units, and we've cut back on all of those because we just want to put less people in jail. Why? Because Rikers Island is being closed and they're going to build four jails, and the four jails are going to be half the size of Rikers Island. So just pragmatically, they're thinking we need to have less people in jail. But some people should be in jail.
Right.
It's just a reality. We don't know what the number needs to be. So that's an issue, and I think we just need to return to that old game plan that we had, proactive policing, and support by the population, that we need police. This is all, this whole defund the police is just politics. That's all it is. The people espousing this do not believe in it. It's all politics, and I think sometimes things need to get worse before they actually get better. And I think this summer is going to be a terrible summer for this city. And if it is a terrible summer, I think some people will wake up, and they'll say, because who's it going to hurt? Most crime in this city. This is sad. This is sad to say. You're talking about victims of crime. 92%, 93%, 94% are people of color. It's not going to affect people like us. It's not going to affect people living in Battery Park. But the people talking about it are the people living in these areas, right? They're talking about it, trying to solve the actual problem. But if you talk to the average person I have a campaign manager. He's from South Bronx. And he's black. The average black person in the South Bronx wants the police in the neighborhood. They respect the police. It's this small fringe element that we need to start speaking up to and saying these people are crazy. They're lunatics. This doesn't make sense. Shame them. And we feel these days when they fight with that shame to the actual moderates, we don't fight back anymore. And I think that's the only option that we have right now. These viewpoints are insane. Just say it. You don't need to be rude. You don't need to call people names or anything. They're insane. The idea itself is insane. We need more funding for the police, not less funding. Do you know what they're doing now? There's these safety agents in school. I just went to a rally for them today. They want to cut the funding for the safety agents, basically fire them all, or put them on a side agency, not under the NYPD. They want to stay at the NYPD. They start their jobs at $32,000 a year. $32,000 is very low for a quasi police officer in these schools. So the whole targeting is not only affecting that street cop that you see, it's also the quasi police officer that's in your kid's school. So people don't understand that. I think when people do see where this trickle down leads to, and this is because of defund the police and a couple of bad apples that were safety agents, and we're going to have them in every job. We're going to have lawyers like me. We're going to have engineers that are bad. We're going to have teachers that are bad. We're always going to have people bad in every job.
In every field,
it's just
yeah.
natural. It's just the way of life, right? I mean, we have bad throughout. So they were definitely a couple of bad safety agents. They were fired. I believe one is being prosecuted. But overall, it was not an issue, and now they want to scrap the safety agent program and bring in outside people. I don't know what they actually want to do with it because they don't know what they want to do with it. But it's politics, right?
Sure.
This is the primary. Primary, you have to go radical left to get your money, and that's what they're doing. To get Soros' money.
Yeah, now, Sean, on that note, and going back, taking like a step back to what Bob was talking about, and you guys were discussing, I've heard you guys talk about the mental health issue. And I offered this up to Sean, you know, in one of our conversations recently. And it kind of shows the more moderate or just logical, free-thinking takeaway. Like you say that the right-winger screams, shouts, lock him up. And then you have the liberal who cries, let him go. But what the compassionate, free-thinking moderate, taking a step back and analyzing the situation, says the actual compassionate thing to do with these folks who are mentally ill is to have them in a facility where they get the treatment they need, they can see their family members, they're not put in these somewhat violent prisons, and they're away from society. And we used to have that in America, and we used to have some rather atrocious, you know, mental health facilities. But if we had clean, safe mental health facilities, didn't you guys think that we could alleviate the problem?
Yeah. I think absolutely.
Go ahead. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, please.
No, I was just going to piggyback on what you were saying, that if you look now, and I could be wrong, but there are less people in these mental health facilities now than there were in previous decades. And so when you have a situation like this where, unfortunately, this mayor, Mayor de Blasio, from what I could tell, has really done nothing to clear out the subway, has done nothing to make sure that these individuals have the treatment that they need, and as a result, the subway, as we mentioned, is less desirable. There's crime rampant, and these individuals are not getting the treatment they need, and it's creating a ripple effect on the city, where now it's you know, just seems like it's been worse as it's been in decades. So there's definitely a correlation, I think, between mental health and the treatment of people that are mentally ill and crime and an overall, you know, the deterioration of life, particularly in New York City.
Yeah, and I think liberals are supposed to be compassionate, right? So I think I think what happens all too often with people on either side is they go at the other person instead of appealing to that person in a diplomatic way, which you could say to liberal individuals like an AOC or these folks that they're liberal, they care about people. You know, it's not compassionate to have these people running around on the street, on the subway. It's compassionate to have them in a safe, clean, you know, facility where they're getting the care they need. I think the semantics of politics is so off base, and that's why nothing ever improves.
The problem that we have too is also judges. I hate to go to state court here because of the quality of the judges that we have is in some cases shameful. I'm being careful here because I may need to appear in front of someone, but we have judges that are elected into office, and it's the same problem. A Democrat will win, but the primary leads to judges that are often far left. It's not always the actual case. Same with prosecutor. So think about this. We have ruled in this state that the right to sleep on the you sleeping on the street is a right that you have, right? and also to involuntarily commit someone to a mental hospital is incredibly difficult in this state because of the judges that we have. So it sometimes sounds easy. Okay, we have to give people good mental health treatment. But if they say they do not want good mental health treatment, what do? We have to go to the court, and we need to win that case in court. Can we win that case in court with the judges that we have? In many cases, the answer is no.
Yeah, see, I wouldn't even know that, yeah.
To involuntarily commit someone to a hospital is a very, very difficult process in almost any state, but particularly in this state.
Yeah, even Sean, even if they've committed a crime, Sean, like let's say you're talking about someone who's attacked someone on a subway, right? And it's clear as day that the person's mentally ill. Rather than give them a little bit of stretch in jail where they're only going to get worse, you know, wouldn't it be more logical to commit them for more an extended period of time? That's kind of what I'm saying. I mean, I'm not talking necessarily about going out with rounding people up, you know, because that could also have a negative connotation. I'm talking about people who get caught up in the system.
Yeah, if you do get caught up in the system, it is possible to actually be sentenced to a mental institution. That is possible. The problem, though, is when do the crimes start to escalate? So we generally start with someone violating very small laws, theft or, you know, minor stuff, and then it escalates. So with those minor type crimes, generally, they will not be sentenced to any time in jail. So if they're not sentenced to any time in jail, they're also not going to be sentenced to any time in a mental hospital. So what I'm actually worried about is that escalation. So most people start with minor crimes, and then it escalates to more serious crimes.
Yeah. And even people who aren't hardened criminals, like you talked about, everybody starts somewhere, right? I've always thought that our system was designed for recidivism. So if someone commits a small crime and gets wrapped up in the system, once they go into prison, there's really no – I'm not talking about rehabilitation. I'm talking about learning a trade somewhere where you could get a job when you get out. You know, there's really nothing like that. I think if we really want to – stop crime in the long term, people are going to get out at a certain point. We should have a program in place in our prisons like they do in other countries where you actually learn a trade, and you don't want to go back to a life of crime because you could make more money and have less stress doing something legitimate, right?
Yeah, I think definitely we have to expand those type programs. One of the big issues is it's hard to get young people to do that. And I think we're losing people within the actual education system. So it all starts with the education system. So many people go through school, have an easy time going through school and an easy time getting out of school. And they're not learning the basic skills needed to be able to become a productive member. And it's such a difficult problem.
I agree with Mike Rowe on that, with what you're saying, which is that we need to teach trades in the schools, because there are a lot of jobs and good paying jobs. There just aren't people who are qualified to take them. And not everybody's going to go to college. And I've got a daughter now that's about to turn 19, who's in college, and she doesn't know what she wants to do. You know, it's just like something to do. You know, I think it's much more productive to offer trades at the high school level.
Yeah, and I think it's not only the concept of a trade, but Germany made it where you still get a great title. So you can still be an engineer, in Germany and the title of an engineer by only going to high school. So then what they do after high school, they actually put you in a trade program, an engineering trade program.
Yeah, an apprentice
and they put
program,
you
yeah.
a company. And after so many years in that company by working under a master engineer, you become an apprentice engineer. Now, we obviously have this same type of thing with electricians and plumbers, but can't you also do that with computer engineers and electrical engineers? And, you know, I think what I learned from school is just the basics to find the answer, right? So I think that's what the education is. I really learned when I did. So I think that's with everything. We're sending everyone to school too long and not having much education anymore. I think it's for every job. It's not only jobs that you do not need to go to college. I think even college is a problem too. We have less hands-on training.
I'm also a believer now, and it's just my personal opinion, that the brick and mortar colleges that charge these small fortunes for tuition, they're going to be a thing of the past, because they're just so antiquated. Everything now is virtual, and that's something that we've learned from Corona. I think within my personal opinion, within 15 years, you're not even going to see them exist anymore.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that as a result that the debt accumulated at these universities are going to be is going to be, and we've already seen proposals from the Democrats to eliminate debt. And I speak selfishly on this because I've went to four different brick and mortar schools, and I agree it's almost useless to go to these universities. They're overcharging their students. They're getting money from the Federal Reserve at a very, very low interest rate and turning around and charging students 10, 15, 20% interest. And what are our students getting? And this is a very, very interesting discussion, school and education. It's something I wanted to turn to, Sean, because this is a very important part of your platform. You write you want to provide world-class education and safety or and work-study opportunities for youth in our schools. I had to ask, what do you think of the school curriculums? We hear reports about, you know, radical ideologies being taught in our school curriculums, like the critical race theory and others. We have the cancel culture now that exists that is certainly affecting our schools and curriculums. I know a lot of individuals I listen to on this issue advise parents to join the school boards and have a say and an influence on, you know, what's going on at their schools and what their children are being taught. I wanted to ask you about that, and I also wanted to ask you what your opinion is on charter schools, versus public schools, and how much does all these other issues we're talking about, economic uncertainty, lack of jobs, high crime, how much does that have an effect on, you know, our students' ability to perform in schools?
Yes. First off, the issue of cancel culture, identity politics, I think it just gets back to us needing to say, this is insane.
Right.
This is not, you know, think about this. You can't bring a Bible into the school and say a prayer in your class, but you can teach ideologies that are definitely not accepted by the vast majority of the population in the U.S. I mean, it's absurd. Now, charter schools, I'm all for charter schools, and I'm all for a voucher program. Now, I don't think we'll ever get it in this city because the teachers' union has such huge power. They have so much power that their pension is not even taxed. So once you get a pension from the school, the pension is not taxed. Now, I know many, many teachers. I have a very good friend that just retired as a New York City public school teacher. We have great, great teachers in this city. I went to the school board meetings. They're all on Zoom right now, so anyone can join. And the teachers are great. However, these curriculums are imposed on them. They don't even have an actual choice. They don't have a choice to teach what they want to teach in class. And I think most teachers are moderate people, right? It's people that are educated. It's people that think. So I think we have in this city some great teachers. And I think our public school system is very good. The problem that we have is the very good schools are the specialized schools, right? And we have some schools in certain areas that are terrible. It's not necessarily the school's fault, though. What can you actually do when most of the people going to the school do not have a father? Most of the people going to the schools does not have a mother. So I think, how do we solve that fundamental issue that we have? And this is not even a black-white issue, because it is the same if you look in Appalachia. In Appalachia, you go to a mountain region, it's the same issue. We have a breakdown of families in the inner city and also rural U.S. How do we address that issue? I have no answer, and I don't think the schools can do it. But I think one thing that we need to say to people, and I don't think this is cruel to say to people, number one, you should not be having children when you're still in high school. And you having children when you are in high school is wrong. But we can't say that anymore. That's shaming. And I think some of this is something that we need to return to that tough love. And if we don't, this is only going to get worse. So I think our educational system, number one, education starts in the family. If the child is being abused by not having parents in the family, it's very difficult to do anything. What do you do? What can a school teacher that has that child for 6-7 hours each day really do? So I think we put too much burden on the school with that. However, I know if I didn't go to the schools that I went to schools that were very, very tough on me, and I was a tough young man when I was in school, I would never be where I am. So if the public schools cannot be tough because of the systems that they have in place, of course we need to send our children to Catholic schools and other non-public programs that maybe can be tougher on those children. That's why I'm for a voucher program, so the middle class parents would be able to send their children to a private school if they believe the private school would give their children a better education.
Yeah, you know, Sean was talking there about the indoctrination aspect, you know, that was the question you initially asked there, Bob. And, you know, my mom was a public school teacher for decades, and she retired at the tail end of the Obama administration, and she was in shock because they actually had a Barack Obama day at her school. She was an elementary school teacher. And she could not believe it. She said, "I'm so glad I'm retiring." And I mean, I'm sure she would have thought the same no matter who the president was, because talk about propagandizing the youth. I mean, it's insane. So I think that may be around the time it started. But I'll tell you, with my own personal life, like my daughter's graduated high school. She actually went to Catholic high school. But even then, like, she went to public school up until 10th grade. Even then, the words that they use and the political correctness, it's unbelievable. It's an indoctrination. And we have a whole generation now that's been indoctrinated into this cancel culture, political correctness. Yep. It's like they're hall monitors. I mean, it's unbelievable. And it's so easily offended. And I'm a big advocate of free speech. And I believe that everybody's right to speak. And no matter if you're far right, far left, we're descending into a world where it's bizarro. I mean, this whole, and it really doesn't affect District 1 with Sean. I'm just more speaking on a broader base nationally. The world we're in right now with this cancel culture and this political correctness is insane.
Yeah, I think that all these issues are connected. I think the radicalization of our children. The irony is that because of technology, anybody can get a blog, anybody can have a podcast like this, anybody can have a voice. But within the public arena, debate is being just swept away, and I'm like you, Matthew. I want free speech no matter what, and we don't see that, and that's unfortunate, and that's almost reminiscent of what happened during the days of Nazi Germany, where we're burning books.
Bob.
Oh,
yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No due process. Yep.
Yeah. This is like the modern day McCarthyism, is exactly what it is, and you could compare it to compare it to Nazi Germany, but I think within our own country's history, a more relevant would be McCarthyism.
Yeah, absolutely. No due process.
Absolutely.
And this happens. This has happened with university professors. It's happened with just about everybody. Go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, I think we can see it's only happening on one side. There's a faculty member, I believe he's in Columbia, and he's arguing right now that the use of heroin should be a right because he just got caught with heroin, and he was making all kinds of concepts about the use of drugs and how it makes him more open to new ideas and stuff like this. And now if you did mention, and I actually de-offended two children that were suspended from NYU, these two children said, I'm calling them children, they're actually college age, but they were young men from South Korea, and NYU suspended them for saying on a chat board, we do not support Black Lives Matter because Black Lives Matter would not support the cause for Asians. Now, if you believe what they're saying is right or wrong, should you be suspended for that? They made no comments about anti-racial, anything like that. They were talking about how this issue is more than just about the police, right? And they were having a rational conversation on an internal message board of their frat, and they both got suspended for that. Now, how bad
things
are actually getting. But a university will not suspend a faculty member for the usage of heroin.
And it's crazy. In that age group, Sean, they are so indoctrinated into the Black Lives Matter. And I think it kind of started with, like I said, the Barack Obama day. And what happens to a country when you have a whole generation that's been indoctrinated this way? I mean, that's going to definitely affect the way they vote.
Oh, sure. That's the actual plan. If you change the actual language, you can't win an argument, right? If you change the actual language to meet your actual needs, how do you win an argument? That's the whole plan here.
It's unbelievable. Bob, you're in this outside of the city. And you're a free thinker, and you're an open guy.
Yeah.
Do you think, having lived in the greater New York City area, that the majority of people buy into this ideology, or do you think it's a small percentage just being forced on the rest of us?
I don't. And you and I have spoken about this, how I have never met anybody that supports this. I have, and I emerged from the radical left. I was at one point in my life as radical left as you can get. I was almost a member of the Workers' World Party, which is, I believe, the only communist party in the country, and their headquarters is in New York at the in New York City. And I volunteered. I went to their conventions, and I was as radical left as you can be. As I got older and changed my mindset, I would put myself in line like you. I'm independent. I'm a free thinker. I don't have an allegiance to any party. I call it as I see it. And the only people that I know that support this are, you know, hardcore radical leftists who I only know primarily through online. I've never met anybody in person that does. And I think this is part of the method of the madness is to have individuals that support this in groups that, you know, call for the boycott and call for the firing of individuals that voice opinions that they don't like, sort of behind the curtain, sort of so that you can't see the enemy and we don't know where to respond. I think it's a really good strategy, and unfortunately, it seems that corporate America has aligned themselves with this culture, probably maybe some sort of financial calculation. Or what you've got? Hollywood, mainstream media, these institutions that
sports
constantly
franchises.
Reinforce sports. They cave right, and Major League Baseball. I mean, we could just go down the line, and I don't know anybody that supports this. In fact, polls indicate 2/3 of Americans are tired and feel threatened by this cancel culture, and it's gotten to the point of just absolutely being ridiculous. So no, and I wanted to stop just on the basis of free speech and the basis of the acceptance of ideas. But it's dangerous for our society. It's reinventing our history, reinventing our society to almost cave to, you know, a pressure, social engineering. I want you to view the world and view people and view historical figures as I do. And if you don't, we're gonna take it away. We're gonna force you to see the world and see history through our eyes, and it's disgusting and it's dangerous.
And Bob, it's coming from four places, and when you stop and take a step back and think about these four places, they're the four places that control thought. You've got Simi Valley and the big tech, right? You've got academia.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Hollywood, and you have big media, mainstream media, and I include in that sports media.
Mm-hmm.
Now think about it. Those four places are what control the dissemination of information and thought in our country.
Yeah.
So those are the four places where they're hardcore cancel culture.
Yeah.
So
I like how
you
laid it out.
I would ask
yeah.
both of you guys, like, where do we go from there at that point? I mean, that's mind control at that point.
I believe, though, I mean, we had problems in our actual past, right? This is not the first problem that we had. I think what will happen here is the mainstream will get angry and they will speak up. They're not speaking up now, right? So I think Trump did some with that mainstream speaking up and some where they were quite radical people, you know, what went on at the, you know, Capitol was an embarrassment. But won't we get, this is the question, won't we get that mainstream person speaking up and being angry when it starts to affect their paycheck, the education of their children, and the safety of their streets? I think that's the question. But I don't think they know how to speak up. Right. What can you rightfully say these days without getting in trouble at work? They're afraid. Right. If you go to a Trump rally wearing a Trump hat, you might even be fired for it. I mean, it's ridiculous. So I think what's needed is
go ahead. I'm
we
sorry.
Have per protection right now for race, sex, gender. Age, blah, 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 blah. Why don't we have a protection in law for opinions? So I think a protection in law for your opinion. And if we had that, you could not get fired for having an opinion that's opposed to your boss. You cannot
That's the ultimate solution. That's actually the ultimate solution because it's getting so bad now. And I'll throw this to Bob that, you know, Dan Severn and Don Fry just did Vlad's show, you know, which is like up there with Rogan, is one of the big YouTube, you know, top YouTube podcasts. and they censored out Don Fry's Trump hat. They blurred it out like it was offensive during the whole interview.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, that's insane. And Dan was telling me about it, and I didn't believe it. I went and watched it. I said, this is unbelievable.
Yeah. I you know, it's, to me, how I respond to it personally is I don't watch, I don't own a television. I would like to, I wish I could say that I was disciplined enough to not buy, you know, some of these products that are associated or that are created or distributed by these entities, Matthew, that you talk about. But another thing that we could do, and Giuliani has talked about this, is let's eliminate the protective status that these tech companies have, like, you know, Facebook and Twitter and so on and so forth, and let's make them susceptible to lawsuits and treat them, you know, not as private private entities, which they are now. I mean, from my understanding,
public,
these companies publicly,
really,
yeah, exactly. They're, you know, they're traded on the public. They have a tremendous influence, and they're censoring certain individuals out there. They're stifling free speech, and then, you know, hiding under the guise that this is just our terms of service, and we're private entities. Once the law is changed, and this is something Trump tried to do before he left office, that may make these media companies less likely to sort of abuse their power.
Yeah, that was what Tulsi Gabbard was proposing. She proposed a lot of good stuff before she left political life, and that was one of the proposals. I agree with that for sure. You know, but Sean could tell us more from a legal perspective if Giuliani's idea is realistic.
I think it's very smart. What the actual law is, since you're a organization that only broadcasts someone else's viewpoints, that this is the actual concept behind it.
Mm-hmm.
You're like a library. It was coming to this type of thought. So a book in your actual library, you put on that shelf. Why should you be able to sue the library for what was put on the shelf? You know what the problem is? They're choosing what's on the shelf. So the actual thought of this internet service provider was an open forum, and they're just providing access. No one thought when that law was made that we were going to have internal censorship of what was going on to the internet, right?
Yeah.
And these companies, the mindset was AOL, right? This was made for a company like AOL that just gave you access to the internet. And now it's something much more. Now, I think both parties, they're talking about this. This is an issue. I think the Democrats, at least the radical wing of the Democratic Party, is not interested in talking about this for obvious reasons. They're the beneficiary. But I think you'll see, and you're going to see a lot of power in these actual years of those moderate Democrats in the Senate, because Biden needs them. So I think we are going to see more of them having the power now to speak up. And I think that's going to be a very good thing. And I think we're also going to see more of the mainstream like us speaking up and also being willing to run for these offices. I mean, this is a heck of a job to be able to do, right? I mean, I ran because I looked at all the other people running. There was only one other candidate in this race that's not for defunding the police. And the two candidates that raised the most money are both defund the police candidates. And I mean, this is scary stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it would happen both ways. If you have an assembly that has no opposition, zero opposition, there's only three Republicans, you pass whatever you want, right? So naturally, when you have this power for a longer period of time, you become more radical. It would happen both ways. And I think we're at the stage now where we are seeing a reawakening like we saw in mid-1990s. And I think that's going to lead to a change. I don't know if it's going to happen this year. I think the candidates for mayor will have to see what flushes out. I don't believe Andrew Young is a moderate candidate. His universal income program, or whatever you want to call it, I think is not moderate if we also don't revise other programs, other housing programs, housing subsidy program and such not. And I also think he's also pandering to the far left. But maybe this is only for the actual primary. We're not sure. I don't know who I'm going to back yet, but I think we can look at some very good Democratic candidates that look like they are more balanced. One's a former police officer and one worked for a very large bank. I won't get into each of them. I don't know everything about him yet. It's still very early. But I'm excited for what we're seeing, who's coming out and what they're actually saying. And I'm following it all now. And I think it's going to be an interesting time for New York. And this is not only here. I think this is happening all over the country right now, where there's a re-talk of the way forward for our large cities. The crime rate in Chicago shot up after bail reform happened in LA and all these other places. So I think those taxpayers, if those taxpayers, and I bet every other place is going to be like that same type of stat, 3-5% of the people pay 60-70% of the taxes. If that's the case and these people do flee to the suburbs, what's going to happen? You know, the cities will die, and we will see what happened like in the 70s and 80s, where our city was broke and the reawakening only happened with the population speaking up, and they were fed up and they threw out Dinkins and do nothing politicians like him and brought in people that were pragmatic. So I'm hopeful.
Awesome.
I'm not a pessimist. I think that this is a city that went through riots with the Irish during the Revolutionary War, with every group, Germans fighting the Chinese on the streets over bakeries. I mean, we have everything in this city, and we've always survived, and we always became stronger. So I think the last maybe half decade to a decade, we started moving from the actual middle, and I think we will come back, and I think it's going to be more people standing up and speaking up, and more people being willing to run for elected office. And that's tough, to be willing to do that. You're an instant target, and it instantly hurts your job. So for most of the people running that I'm actually running against, this job is something that they would love to have. Most of them don't have jobs. They're people like community organizers, or they volunteer for a homeless shelter or something like that. And this is going to be the best job they ever have. The city council voted themselves a pay raise over the last 5-6 years. Now what the pay is, it's $148,500 for a part-time job. It's higher than the
great
salary
grab for
you guys. As a state senator. It's ridiculous. They just, because there's no opposition.
Yeah, so, Sean, it's one of the things you said there that I was intriguing that might be good for the city and send a good message is you said there's an actual – is it an NYPD, a retired NYPD officer that's running?
There is. I think there's actually two. Eric Stevens.
Cool.
Yeah, so he was. I believe he was a detective. I'm not sure. I don't know everything about his background, but he seems to be a moderate politician. And we're going to know a lot more. It's still very early, very very early. So don't choose yet. Don't make a choice yet.
What does it look like as far as debates, as far as the process, when do things really get started? When do they really kick off?
May, you know, so we're going to see in May really things. Yeah, that's when you can start to understand more about what's going on. Everyone right now is really focused on fundraising. So the fundraising part of it is a little bit different than the way you pitch to the voters. So they're still pitching fundraising now. So they're meeting community organizers and all of this stuff now, and they don't necessarily get their full viewpoints out yet. So the primaries on June 22nd. The primaries on June 22nd, Democratic primary. I just took a picture today with Sliwa. Remember from the Guardian Angel?
Oh, yeah. He's running for mayor. I remember him from Morton Downey, Morton Downey Jr. show.
And he's looking strong. And he's...
Yeah, he used to be Morton Downey Jr. show. That, now, I'm just kind of dating myself. You can get carpal tunnel that way, but he was on the Morton Downey Jr. show back in the old days.
Yeah, he's still a healthy guy, and he's still strong speaker, and a very, very interesting man. I forgot his job was, but prior to starting the Angels, he had some like a doorman or something, some basic job.
Yeah, he worked at a McDonald's.
Is
he worked at a McDonald's on Fordham Avenue. He's a working class guy. He's been on radio for years, WABC. He was on 970.
Yep.
He had a show on WABC with Ron Kuby, who's part of the parole board now in New York, which we talk about crime, we talk about recidivism, you know, and we talk about dangerous people being let out. That's another discussion there. And he's running for mayor against Fernando Mateo. I listened to the debate that they had on WABC, I think earlier this month, and it was really, really interesting. He may win the primary, but New York City is really, as you mentioned, that's another ball game with the voting populace there, with Republicans just not really have any type of standing whatsoever in the state of New York. But there was Rudy Giuliani. There was other Republican outliers that came in and made it. George Pataki that made a difference. So you never say never.
Bob, I'm going years. I'm going back a lot of years, Bob. But I remember him from Morton Downey, and I remember him. Of course, that was a pretty wild show. He's getting up and yelling at people and going. He's probably calmed himself down over the years.
Not really.
he's
still
a tough guy. He's tough.
Yeah, he was, with the Black Lives Matter protests. Him and the Guardian Angels were there. He got his jaw broken recently. He patrols the subways. He talks to a lot of the mentally ill there, and he's been doing it since he's 5 years old, apparently, according to him. He's been riding the subway, and so he's in his 60s.
Maybe we could get him in a professional wrestling ring. Bob, maybe we could get him in a professional wrestling ring, because I wanted to kind of segue to, Bob, is because we've had such a lengthy discussion about politics, I was issued a challenge. Stefan Bonner and I were issued a challenge from a man you know really well, UFC welterweight champion and Hall of Famer Pat Miletich, has called us out along with his broadcast partner, Jeffrey Wilson. They want to have a battle of the broadcast teams. And Pat and Jeffrey have been making some very incendiary remarks about Stefan Bonner and I. And they have challenged us to a tag team match. And I can tell you, that I talked to Kenny Lester down in Florida today, who was the heavyweight wrestler at ASU right after Cain Velasquez. And he's in the world of professional wrestling now. He has a promotion down in Florida that wants to have this match.
Oh, wow.
And
in a squared
I
circle?
I can tell you.
Is it going to be
in the
squared
circle? This is a tag team match in the squared circle. It's a new promotion in the world of – it's a hybrid promotion that's going to be going down in the world of professional wrestling. I think we might have talked about it a little bit when I was on your show last time. It's a promotion called RPW, Real Pro Wrestling, that's going to feature a lot of former UFC stars. And the very first event in Florida, it looks like – Stefan Bonner and I will be teaming up in the battle of the broadcast teams. as Pat Miletic, the Croatian sensation, makes his debut in the world of professional wrestling, along with his broadcast partner, Jeffrey Wilson, who is not a man to take lightly. He's a highly skilled guy himself on the mic and the mat. But I have a feeling that after consulting with Stefan Bonner earlier, that we are going to stretch these two welterweights like rubber bands.
All right. I want to see that, man. That's going to be huge.
Yeah, it's going to be the next big tag match. So I wanted to get that out there. I didn't want to interrupt with the pub, but we've had such a lengthy talk of politics, talking about Mr. Sliwa being a tough guy. And I remember him from the Morton Downey Jr. days and Geraldo Rivera, and as being somewhat of a professional wrestling type persona. So I figured it would be an opportunity to segue to that.
Sliwa told me a story today. He said one day he was walking down the street, and he was walking down the street. On his right side was a Republican. On his left side was a Democrat. And they're all walking down the street, and a trash can falls over. And out of the trash can came a golden lantern. All three of them at the same time jumped on that golden lantern. Out of the golden lantern came a genie, and the genie says, "I shall grant you three wishes." And Sliwa says, "I get the wishes." The Republican says, "I get the wishes." The Democrat says, "I get the wishes." And the genie says, "Listen, stop arguing about this. You're each going to get one wish." So the Republican said, "You know what I want?" He goes, "I want to become the governor of New York, but I want to split New York in two. I want to be the governor of upstate New York. So we'll have an upstate New York and we'll have a downstate New York. And I want all of my Republicans from the tri-state area to move to upstate New York, and I will be their governor." And the genie says, "Wish is my command." Boom, he's in upstate New York. The Democrat says, "That Republican's smart. I want the same. I want all the Democrats in the tri-state area to come to New York City and Long Island, and I will be the governor of downstate New York." Boom, he's a governor. Sliwa scratches his head, and he says, "You know what I want? I want a ticket, a train ticket to Connecticut." The genie says, "You can wish for anything in the world, and you're going to wish for a train ticket to Connecticut?" He goes, "Yes. What else do I have to actually wish for? All the Republicans and Democrats are gone."
That's funny stuff.
True story.
That's a
true
good
story.
One, yeah.
That's hilarious. Yeah, he. I've seen him, King. Used to go to the Martial Arts World Expo in New York City. He's a martial artist. He's a big fan of martial arts. And so, I don't agree with all of his political opinions, but I do respect him as the founder of the Guardian Angel for years. And I respect the Guardian Angels, and I respect his public service and whatnot.
Yeah, and I tell you, that's a good segue too, Bob, because I respect everyone. And I never agree with anyone in all their political opinions, because I always say, if you agree with everything I say, then you aren't thinking for yourself, right?
That's
so,
right.
You know, everybody, he's got to think for yourself.
I actually brought him up, too. I actually brought him up. You know, think about when he came out. I'm not sure if maybe it was in the late 70s, early 80s, but that's when things were really bad here. And he felt motivated to stand up and do something. That's what I have respect for him. And I think I didn't get to ask him that today. I talked to him for about 10 minutes, but I didn't get to ask him that question. And when I see him next time, I want to ask him, is he doing this right now because he feels the same? That's what he's saying. But I kind of wonder, does he feel like he's getting that calling one more time? Because I think someone from a job that he was doing, you would not get this huge change. And I think he has that calling right now. And I don't know if he believes he can win, but he's definitely out there working really hard. Get the actual message out there that we need the police, right? He's a crime fighting guy. That's why he's actually doing it. I think that's why he's doing it, because he doesn't need money. He's not raising. Yeah. I actually pulled up how much he raised. He's not raising a lot of money, and he's not going around with a big crowd. He has that one guy that always is with them, and he's doing it, getting out and speaking and talking about the need for the police. So I think he feels called one more time.
Yeah, I can remember, and you know, it was a time that younger folks won't remember, but I remember that time in the 80s when you had Geraldo Rivera and Morton Downey Jr. And there was another guy that you might remember, Bob, being from Jersey, Richard Bay. Remember the Richard Bay show was really big on Channel 9, WOR. And I remember that the Guardian Angels on those shows, he had a sister named Lisa, the Sliwa, that he used to go on those shows with. And they were real combative. I just remember it was those days like when Geraldo got his nose broken by a flying chair from one of the one of the skinheads, and he would go on all these shows, and you know who the other guy was that was always on these shows was Reverend Al Sharpton, back when he was real heavy set, you know, and that was kind of like what got me into politics when I was younger, right? Because they were talking about these political issues, but it was like pro wrestling, you know. These talk shows were like pro wrestling.
Yeah, I remember it.
Bob Grant. Bob Grant?
Bob Grant was another one.
Passed away, Sliwa was actually shot a bunch of times by John Gotti Jr. John Gotti Jr.
Oh, really?
Shot five times. He's a real tough guy. John Gotti Jr. stood trial for that many, many times.
Bob, on that regard, not to interrupt you, but on that regard of John Gotti Jr., do you know Phil Baroni's history outside of fighting?
Yeah, you were telling me about this. Yeah.
Yeah. So his father was a Gold Star detective in NYPD, and he was working for both sides. You know, I actually just interviewed a guy, Larry Mazza, that was a hitman for the Columbo. I interviewed him for Hannibal. And Phil Sr., Phil's dad, he was working both sides while he was a detective. But then after he retired, he got wrapped up with the Gambinos, and he was using his badge to rob drug dealers. They had a whole bunch of stuff going on. They were doing a car ring with a guy New Year's ago where they were stealing cars and all this stuff. And Phil, this is the crazy thing about Phil. When Phil was wrestling at Hofstra, he was really good. You know, he got stabbed in the back of the head because when he was collecting money. And that's when he had to go to wrestle in Michigan because he had to get out of New York. And then his father got wrapped up in that trial and that whole Gotti, that was the Gotti Jr. trial. So there's so many crazy things that revolve around the city of New York, you know, that have happened over the years. But that one for you would be is really interesting. You ought to have Phil on one time, you know, Bob. Have you ever interviewed Phil?
I had a press conference when Phil fought Joe Riggs for Strikeforce. I was on the conference call, and I asked Phil, and Phil, he probably doesn't remember this, but Phil, I sound a lot like Eddie Goldman, and Phil thought I was Eddie Goldman. Yeah, and Phil, Eddie Goldman was on Eddie Goldman asked Phil a question, and Phil thought Eddie was me. And Phil was pissed off because I asked Joe Riggs about Phil, and I said, listen, is Phil a little wary from all the punches? I may have phrased it differently, and Phil kind of got pissed because he thought he heard the interview. He thought Eddie was me, and he kind of like snapped at him. But no, I would love to have Phil. He's a real fascinating guy. I think he's had a very, very good career. And he's still doing as of a few years ago. He's still doing bare knuckle, and he's doing grapple.
Yeah, I'm going to send you a video of when I was on Hannibal to talk about that. I had booked him for that bare knuckle fight against Chris Lieben.
Yes.
And he never got paid. That was the organization where the guy ended up going to prison. And he had big contracts because I had moved Phil out to Freeman's camp, Matt Freeman's camp, and they did a sit down interview with. I did an interview with Phil on Hannibal before the fight. And then Hannibal did a sit-down interview with me after because Bass Rutten was taking a lot of heat over that because he was sticking up for this guy and nobody was getting paid. You know, and this was a couple years ago. To this day, no one on that card has gotten paid, including
That's
Chris Lieben. Chris Lieben stood up for those guys for a long time, and then he broke off and he went and worked for the other bare-knuckle promotion
Nate
Shook was matchmaker for.
So
that was the one I was telling you, you know, that I was kind of wary of those guys too a little bit. You know, but I'll send you those interviews. They're really, really entertaining.
We
was such a cluster.
Yeah, we could have a great interview with Phil, because, you know, a lot of these media places now, they're focused on the UFC, and they're focused on, you know, what UFC event, what the UFC, because they make money from the UFC, and their livelihood depends on the UFC. This is an independent podcast, so I could talk with Phil, explore all these different points in his career and his life that would be absolutely great for the record out there and for, you know, people to listen to understand the career and the life of Phil Baroni. Sean, listen, I think we're going to kind of wrap it up here. We've went on for a long time, and I really feel that we've really went in depth on local issues, national issues, had a really good free-flowing conversation that I knew we would have and can get a feel for you. And you feel like a real honest guy that wants to make a difference. You seem to be running a real respectful campaign, have a real pragmatic and clear view of what the future can be in District 1 and beyond. And I just want to ask you, is there anything that you want to say in closing? We want to give people a chance to visit your website or anything else that you want to convey to the people before we wrap it up on this Sunday afternoon.
Yes, absolutely. You know, if anyone wants to phone me, contact me, talk to me, I'm very, very willing to talk to anyone and everyone. So we could be contacted at 212-929-1812 or at info@SeanHayes4NewYorkCity.com. So that's info@SeanHayes4NewYorkCity.com. And the phone number one more time is 212-929-1812. Thank you so much for having me on. It was fun. It was a fun time. Thank you so much. Time went by quick. We were on for about an hour and 50 minutes. It seems like 10.
Yeah, no, thank you, King, for setting us up and for introducing me to Sean. And I like to a chance to visit you guys, Matt, when you come up to New York and help out. That'll be great. You know, I wish you the best of luck on the campaign. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm going to be up there soon. I'm going to be up there April 21st. I'll send you my itinerary, Bob, so you see it. And I'd love to see you. And maybe we could we could have you on our show, because Sean and I are going to start a podcast, you know, when I get up there. And that's another thing we wanted to announce while we were on here. And we'll have you as one of our first guests.
I really appreciate that. And give people at home your information where they could check your content. You're very, very busy. You got so many projects, got so many different things going on. And you know, where can people follow you and keep track of what you got going on?
For me, the best thing is to just follow my Facebook is Matthew J. Granahan, and go on Hannibal TV and look at all my interviews and my I'm a major contributor for him, King of Connecticut. He's interviewed me a number of times. I've done a number of interviews with fighters and very entertaining commentaries. And then you can also look at my Instagram, which is king.of.connecticut. And then one last thing too, Eric Paulson contacted me the other day, and we were joking about how our book has aged like a fine cellar wine. There are people seling it on Amazon for $250 a copy. You can still go on Eric Paulson's website, ericpaulson.com. You go on the store. You can actually still buy copies there 11 years later, a true cult classic.
Yes, absolutely. Folks, you won't be sorry. Follow Matthew, the King of Connecticut. Also, visit Sean's website, SeanHayes4NYC.com. Make sure to donate and be in contact with him. It's very rare that you get access to a city council candidate for such a long time, and someone who's so willing to, I think, you know, interact with his constituents, having an office there, and spent so many time in that district. So thank you so much to both of you, and I look forward to seeing you sometime soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob. Take care, guys. All right, that was it for this week's edition of Carson's Corner. Again, big thanks to Sean Hayes and Matthew Granahan. We wish them the best of luck in their campaign, and you know, we'll be following it, and hopefully, you know, I can go out there to New York City and see them and you know, discuss these issues from a very, very humble and much-needed perspective. My name is Bob Carson. You've been listening to Carson's Corner. If you want to keep in contact with me, you can follow me on Instagram, instagram.com/BobCarsonMMA. Go on Facebook, facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. And the radio show is, podcast is here on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/Carson's Corner. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.